You told me where you were staying. Remember? And I did try to reach you this afternoon to tell you I was coming. As you would know, if you ever, just once in a while, answered your phone. But I checked out of the St. Regis this morning. How did you know I would come back here? I didn't decide myself until a few minutes ago. He shrugged. Lucky guess. Where else would you go?
Well, this is... It's incredibly sweet of you. But don't you have, like, a job? Patients you're supposed to be seeing?
Look, if you want me to turn around and go home, just say the word.
Will sounded offended. It's not that, I just...
And actually, caring for patients is my job, he continued huffily, although you'd be amazed how helpful it is when they do what I tell them. To take a wild example, when I've wrangled an appointment with one of the most respected surgeons in Washington, it's helpful when my patients bother to show up, as opposed to, say, embarrassing me, ignoring my medical advice, and carrying on in a way that is, frankly, reckless.
I held up my hands. Touché.
To answer your original question, I don't see patients on Fridays. It's my writing day. I don't see patients after lunch on Thursdays either. But thanks for your concern about my practice.
Okay, sorry. He stepped back, crossed his arms on his chest, and regarded me with an expression that was half angry, half sheepish.
Another thing I don't usually do is fly around the country chasing down disobedient patients. But you sounded like you were in trouble. I feel responsible.
Responsible? Why? What is all this?
I screwed up. I told you to slap on a wrist brace and you'd be fine. I should have taken your wrist pain more seriously. Should have ordered an MRI months ago. I wouldn't blame you if you sued me for malpractice. But I'm trying to put things right, so here I am.
So here you are. We stood facing each other awkwardly. Did he expect me to thank him? To reach out and shake his hand? Lean in for an embrace? This encounter was clearly beyond the remit of the typical doctor-patient relationship. But what otherwise was our relationship? Unspoken words hung in the air.
Hungry?
God, yes, I said, grateful to have the silence broken. And I was hungry. I hadn't eaten since Ethan Sinclair had bought me breakfast this morning. I could do with a drink, too. He glanced around.
Where's the bar?
I'm not actually sure. There's a restaurant upstairs, but... You know, I don't think I've eaten anywhere besides this hotel in 3 days. I keep ordering room service. Would you mind if we went out? It didn't take long for the concierge to size us up. He recommended two places nearby. One was high-end sushi, and the other a steakhouse. He probably got a cut for every reservation he steered their way. When I insisted we didn't need fancy, that my primary concern was an icy pitcher of margaritas, he relented and directed us to a place called the Georgia Grill.
Order the jalapeno poppers, he said. Trust me on this.
15 minutes later, it seemed that trusting him might have been a mistake. The Georgia Grill was one of the least inviting restaurants I'd ever seen. Set in the back corner of a bland strip mall, it was squashed between a dry cleaner's and the parking lot. Neon letters spelled out the name across a grimy stucco wall. You couldn't see inside. There were no windows. No way to tell if the place was even open. This can't be right, I said, checking the piece of paper where the concierge had scribbled the name. What was he thinking? It looks awful.
It does, agreed Will. If it's as bad inside as out here, let's maybe try that steakhouse after all.
He held open the door. We stood squinting on the threshold. Once our eyes adjusted to the darkness inside, we decided to stay. The place was packed. An old wormwood bar slouched across one wall. The walls were painted tawny butterscotch, and candles glowed on every surface. The scents of roasted pork and fresh tortillas hung in the air. It was hard to imagine a starker contrast with the dingy exterior. We slid onto two seats at the bar. I peeled off my jacket and looked around.
"Y'all look like you wouldn't say no to a couple of margaritas,"
the bartender peered at us. "You read my mind."
"Y'all planning to eat, too? Want to look at a menu, or just let me tell you what's good?"
He salted the rims of two glasses.
"Lobster enchilada's the best thing on the menu."
"Sold," said Will.
"I should clarify, it's the best thing on the menu, unless it's a Thursday night, which I believe you'll find it is. In which case, what you want is the cowboy shrimp special."
"I don't know," I said. "I'm not a big shrimp eater."
"Fat, juicy babies grilled up on a bed of grits, with bacon and white beans and spinach."
"I take it back. You had me at bacon."
"Smart girl."
"Oh, and the jalapeno, what was it we were supposed to ask for?" I looked at Will. "The fritters?"
"The poppers."
The bartender set down our drinks.
"That went without saying."
I was beginning to feel better. Funny how a large margarita and the prospect of a good meal can do that. I downed my drink in two long swallows and signaled for another. Will raised his eyebrows.
"I guess you needed that."
"Like I said, it's been a hell of a day."
"Just as long as you stay away from the rye. Not that I wouldn't enjoy having to throw you over my shoulder and carry you home."
I pretended to scowl. Will was tall and broad-shouldered. He would have no trouble slinging me over his shoulder and carting me off. Tonight he looked annoyingly good. He wore a camel-colored cashmere sweater and boot-cut Levi's. "May I ask you a personal question?" I asked.
Sure. Shoot."
"Have you ever owned a pair of black skinny jeans?"
"Skinny jeans? You mean like mall rat teenage girls wear?"
I laughed. "I guess so."
No. I'm afraid that's a glaring omission from my wardrobe. Why?"
The tequila was hitting my bloodstream. I smiled at him. "No reason." He gave me a quizzical look, then cleared his throat.
"Look, Caroline, at the risk of embarrassing myself, can I say something? I meant what I said before. If you want me to walk away tonight and never bother you again, I will. Okay? The last thing I want to do is make you uncomfortable, especially with everything else you're dealing with. And Lord knows my own life doesn't need any more complications. But I really like you. I do. I have for a while."
His eyes held mine.
"I'd like to help you, if you'll let me."
I felt something soften inside me. "I'd like that too. And I'm glad you flew down." The words spilled out before I had time to think. I was surprised to realize they were true. My cheeks burned, and I busied myself tracing my finger around the rim of my glass and licking off the salt.
"You're blushing."
"I am not."
He swiped his hand across his mouth to hide a grin. "Fine. Change of subject, then. Wanna tell me about your day from hell?"
"Oh, it's been the longest day ever," I sighed. "The phone started ringing before I even got out of bed. First, this guy who used to play tennis with my dad. With Boone Smith, I mean. And then this cop called."
Hang on. Why were these people calling you? How do they even..."
"Because of the newspaper story." Will looked blank. "The Journal Constitution wrote a profile about me coming back to Atlanta. It's on the front page today."
"You're on the front page of today's paper? Seriously?"
"Yeah."
"Jesus, I must have walked right past it at the airport."
"Well, every single other person in Atlanta seemed to see it." I described for Will how I'd met Beamer Beasley in the newsroom and what he'd told me about the day of the murders. Eventually, I arrived at what Beasley had told me about the bullet itself. Will went pale and touched my hand.
That must have been awful to hear.
Yes, I wanted to claw it out right there. I still do.
I shuddered.
I don't blame you. We were both still. Then suddenly Will sucked in his breath.
Tell me again what exactly the cop wanted to know about the bullet. When he asked whether you could feel it in your neck.
That was pretty much it, I think.
My forehead wrinkled with concentration.
Beasley was walking me downstairs, and he asked whether the bullet hurt, whether I'd ever explored getting it surgically removed.
Will threw me a sharp look. You see why he was asking that. It sounds like your case preyed on him all these years. He never solved it. No wonder he wanted to meet with you.
What are you talking about?
He told you there was no physical evidence, right? Don't you think the police would have liked to get their hands on the bullets? Then they might have figured out what type of gun was used. Maybe they could have identified the actual murder weapon. I'm not sure how these things work, but Beasley said the bullet that hit your father disappeared, right? And the other one was off limits to police because it was sewn up inside a hurt little girl. Inside you, Caroline. You're walking around with the evidence in your neck.
Somehow, this precise point had not occurred to me. I'd been so caught up with the horror of that bullet having traveled through Sadie Rawson's flesh that I hadn't stopped to consider its potential utility as forensic evidence.
Do you think that's why Beasley wanted to see me? I asked Will.
To find out if there was any chance of extracting it?
Will shrugged. I don't know. But imagine if you were him, and you unfolded your morning paper to find a case that had haunted you your whole career plastered across the front page. He must have choked on his coffee. Of course he wanted to question you. Does the article mention that the bullet is still intact and in your neck?
I shrank down. Yes. They ran the image of the X-ray.
That was in the newspaper?
Will looked aghast. They wanted proof that I wasn't making all this up.
Okay. Okay.
He took a deep breath.
To speak to your question, I have no idea whether Atlanta police would have the resources or indeed the interest in reopening a case that sat cold for 30-something years. But Beasley wouldn't be much of a cop if he hadn't asked, would he?
He also asked whether coming back here had jogged any memories.
Yeah. That would be the other thing I would want to know if I were in his shoes.
I told him it hadn't.
Nothing at all? Even going back to visit your old house?
I shook my head. There was a moment. I thought I remembered where a light switch should be, and there it was, on the stairs leading up to the attic. But no, nothing about my family or how they died.
I'm glad, actually. Glad you don't have to relive that day.
My right arm had been resting on the bar, and now he laid his arm against it. We were barely touching, but where his skin brushed mine, the hairs stood up, instantly electric.
How's your wrist?
The same, I managed.
I've seen you drawing circles like this. Does that help?
His finger traced a slow circle on the white skin inside my wrist. I nodded, closed my eyes. The room tilted. His finger circled again, more firmly now. I was finding it hard to breathe. You're not my type.
That's a shame. Another circle. For what it's worth, you're not my type either.
My eyelids fluttered open. I'm not? Why?
Well, for starters, I usually steer clear of women who set off metal detectors even when fully undressed.
I smiled. He smiled. Then he stretched out his leg until it pressed against mine, hip against hip, knee against knee. You could feel hard muscle outlined beneath his Levi's, could feel the heat rising off his skin. Later, in a dark corner of the parking lot. He leaned me back against a doorway. With one hand, he gently braced my neck. With the other, he traced the same slow circle over my blouse, around the tips of my breasts. He took his time, slow and slower still. His fingers circled and curved and teased until I was dizzy, until I heard myself moan. Until, for the first time in days, the throbbing in my body was nowhere near my neck. 20. Friday, October 18th, 2013.
Good morning, madam.
My usual waiter greeted us at breakfast. He eyed Will and me with an uneasy expression, as though he wasn't quite sure what to do with us. I checked my watch. It was barely 7 o'clock. Perhaps the restaurant wasn't yet open for business? Will had dragged me out of bed half an hour ago, adamant that we needed to get to the airport and talk our way onto an early flight home. I had agreed on the condition that we grab a decent breakfast first. The waiter eventually turned, beckoned us to follow, and showed us to a secluded table behind a gigantic potted plant. He presented the menus with a flourish.
Now then, the kitchen's just getting going. Fresh orange juice? Are you leaning toward the yogurt or the sweet potato pancakes today?
I smiled. The man had memorized my breakfast preferences while I hadn't even learned his name. I made a mental note to leave a big tip. The pancakes again. You have an astonishing memory.
Thank you. I also recall that you prefer the pancakes with a side of sausage.
Make that a really big tip. You recall correctly. Thanks.
Very good. How about for your, friend?
The uneasy look again.
Just coffee and toast. Whole wheat, please.
Will told him. The waiter nodded, glanced at me again, hesitated. Then, as if he couldn't help himself,
"Will any of your other friends be joining you for breakfast?"
It took a second, and then I got it. Even luxury hotels such as the St. Regis must see their share of the world's oldest professionals. I had now waltzed in with a different man on my arm 3 mornings in a row. And today, Will and I were no doubt radiating the rumpled glow of 2 people who've just enjoyed great sex and little sleep. My poor waiter probably assumed I was a high-end hooker, a hooker whose services included a weird ritual of making her clients buy her pancakes afterward.
"Your other friends?"
Will asked after the waiter walked away. "Don't worry about it." Will raised his eyebrows, then let it drop.
"How's your neck?" he said instead.
"Fine." It was nearly true.
"And your wrist?"
I flexed it up and down. "The same. Sore." He reached across the table and lifted my right arm to examine it. His fingers laced through mine, rotating my wrist in one direction and then the other. Tiny needles of pain shot out.
"Ow! I told you, it's sore."
"Just checking your range of motion."
He slid his hand out of mine, rested my arm back on the table, and traced a slow circle inside my wrist.
"I gather this feels better."
Don't start that again, or we'll wind up back upstairs.
"Where you could demonstrate again for me what an astonishing range of motion you enjoy in other parts of your body."
I swatted him with my good hand.
"Shh." "Sorry," he said, not looking sorry at all. "So, let's see. We could talk about..."
He drummed his fingers on the tabletop.
"It's a shame, actually, that we have to race back to Washington. I keep meaning to check out Turner Field one of these days."
"What's that?"
"The Braves, silly. Home field for the Braves. The baseball team here in Atlanta."
I stifled a yawn. "They're pretty good, right?"
Will lit up. "Yeah, not bad. Just won their division."
Did they win the World Series this year? I asked by way of making conversation.
Did they win the World Series this year? Repeated Will, sitting back and staring at me in disbelief. Tell me you didn't just ask that. The World Series hasn't happened yet. It starts next week. The Cards play the Dodgers tonight in St. Louis, and then tomorrow's the American League, Red Sox versus the Tigers in Boston. Huge game. How can you not know that?
But isn't baseball a summer sport? Shouldn't this be the off-season? This time, I could not hold back a yawn. Baseball, Johnny Cash. Was there no end to the topics that animated this man and bored me senseless?
Will was now gaping at me as if I were an alien just landed from Mars. Are you actually American? Or do they brainwash you before they let you join the French department? Make you swear only to follow, I don't know, competitive cheese-eating, escargot racing?
The French are excellent at soccer and tennis, Formula One racing, and let's see, pétanque.
What the hell is pétanque?
It's, you know, like boule. You have metal balls and you try to roll them as close as possible to a wooden ball, the cochonnet. Will snorted.
I stand corrected. That sounds gripping.
Oh, you're impossible.
Tell you what, how about as a special treat, sort of a remedial educational service, we watch the World Series together. The opening game is on Wednesday. I'll explain everything, teach you the mechanics of the game.
Wow, that sounds tempting.
My brothers have tried episodically over the years to educate me about baseball. They share a block of season tickets for the Nationals, Washington's wildly popular franchise. Every once in a while, when enough time has elapsed that I've forgotten what torture it is to sit through 9 innings, they persuade me to come along. Tony buys the beer while Martin devotes himself to explaining for the umpteenth time the difference between a player's batting average and his on-base percentage. I remind him that I haven't even mastered which is left field and which is right field. The only useful piece of information I've picked up is that Section 109 is home to an outpost of Ben's Chili Bowl, which sells a mean half-smoke.
So we're on for Wednesday?
Will was waiting for an answer.
Sure, okay. But not at some sports bar. Your place?
No, let's say yours.
Deal.
Yes, that would be better. I could cook. I'd still be stuck watching baseball, but at least we would eat well.
I'll bring scorecards. Show you how to track all the stats.
Now you're pushing it.
He grinned and pushed back from the table.
At the risk of boring you further, would you excuse me a second? I've got a few voicemails I need to respond to. Be right back.
I watched him walk away with some relief. I needed a moment alone to collect myself. What on earth was I doing here? With Will Zartman? With my physician, for God's sake, in an Atlanta hotel, flirting over pre-dawn pancakes? Clearly, I was not myself. The last 24 hours had brought a tumult of contradictory emotions. 1 minute found me weeping, the next gobbling up jalapeno poppers and giggling like a schoolgirl. I wasn't sure what I felt anymore, other than raw. It would take time to process everything I'd learned yesterday. And now, this thing with Will. It was true. He wasn't my type. But that didn't seem to be preventing my feeling attracted to him. Will, the earnest, solicitous doctor in Washington, him I could resist. But this less predictable man, who'd flown to Atlanta on a whim and then kept me up all night, well, he was intriguing. I studied him as he wove through the restaurant, absorbed in his phone conversation. He was wearing the same Levi's and cashmere sweater as before. The jeans hugged him in interesting places. Maybe I liked the bootcut look after all. This would be a ludicrous time to start a relationship. My whole world had just been upended. But no one ever argued that laws of reason and logic apply to the chemistry between a man and a woman. Will caught my eye from across the room and winked, held up one finger to indicate he would be just another minute. I winked back. It had been a while since I'd had a crush. You would think I'd be too old for such nonsense, that at 37 I would have graduated to responding less like a teenage girl and more like a sensible woman approaching middle age. It was a pleasure to discover this was not the case. Part 3. Washington. 21. Sibley Hospital is a gleaming, state-of-the-art facility set deep in well-tended lawns. It's the kind of place that makes you grateful to live in 21st century America. No one wants to suffer dire illness or injury, but should it happen, it's reassuring to know that the best medical care money can buy exists right up the street. I'd never visited Sibley before. The elevator deposited me on the fifth floor, hushed, carpeted corridors, a closed-in smell of disinfectant and dust, as though the air had been recycled many times. It must have been years since someone had thought to throw open a window. I found my way to the Division of Neurological Surgery, where the dimly lit blue and green waiting room felt vaguely aquatic and was presumably meant to be calming. At 3 o'clock sharp, a sturdy-looking nurse in scrubs called my name. We went through the usual routine, checking my weight, steady despite the cheeseburger frenzy, my blood pressure, my temperature. "All right, then," she peeled the pressure cuff off my arm and indicated for me to climb down from the examination table. "Let's get this CT scan done, and then you can relax a bit while Dr. Gellert reads the results." I looked up, startled. "A CT scan? Do I really need that?" "Yes, ma'am, apparently you do." She was already holding open the door to the hallway. "But hang on, I already got an MRI. CT's different, uses X-rays." "I already got an X-ray, too." "Not like this, you didn't. This one, you lie flat and slide in, then they take loads and loads of pictures. Slices. The doctors stack the slices on top of each other, and we can see your whole head in 3D. It's cool. You'll see." I felt a stab of frustration. The afternoon would slip away. I had a pile of mail waiting at home for me, not to mention piles of laundry and no food in my fridge. "How long will it take?" "You're gonna like this." "I doubt that," I whined. 30 seconds.
30 seconds?
"New machine. I told you, it's cool." The 30-second estimate, of course, referred only to the time needed to perform the CT scan. The time needed to review the results was another matter. My nurse assured me that I'd been tagged an urgent priority. Still, it was pushing 5:30 p.m., and I had read Vogue cover to cover, called my mother, and placed an online grocery order with Safeway by the time Marshall Gellert strolled in. He was a slight, intense man in his 50s. He perched on the edge of a stool, scrutinizing me with hawk-like eyes colored an almost otherworldly shade of blue. But what you noticed were his hands. They never ceased moving. As he spoke, they danced up and down his thighs, darted into his pocket, produced a pen, and twirled it across his knuckles in tight, precise loops. He seemed unaware. I couldn't take my eyes off them. Those fingers might soon be slicing a scalpel into my neck.
"Dr. Zartman was adamant that I should see you immediately."
"He can be pushy that way." The hawk eyes bore down.
"I'll admit it's an extraordinary case. The survival rate for being shot in the head would be 1 in several thousand at best."
I nodded. What could one say?
"Extraordinary that your brainstem wasn't injured. I've got your whole file."
He opened a purple folder on his lap. The profile from yesterday's journal Constitution peeked out from near the bottom. He'd done his homework.
"The cranial computed tomography indicates no neural damage,"
The foreign body is just below the left side of the foramen magnum. I held up my hands. In plain English, please.
Sorry. The bullet's 1.3 centimeters long, roughly half an inch, lodged below the opening where your spinal cord passes through and connects to your brain. Here we go.
Mounted on the wall beside us was a flat-screen monitor. Dr. Gellert reached over to flick it on. After a moment, the sharpest image I'd yet seen came into focus. A stark outline of my skull, my teeth, and the bullet, glowing white as usual.
What's unclear is why it may have shifted after all these years, if indeed it has.
Will thinks my spine has compressed.
Will?
Dr. Zartman, I mean.
I let my hair fall across my face to hide my blush. Well, that's a decent theory. At any rate, your symptoms certainly suggest movement of some sort, which makes you a more urgent candidate for intervention than if it were causing you no trouble.
Your advice, then, is to go ahead and remove it? But I've been told it's surrounded by nerves and blood vessels. I frowned at the screen. Even to my untrained eye, it looks awfully close to my spinal cord.
It couldn't get much closer,
he agreed, a tad cheerfully for my liking.
Miss Cashin, the truth is that with an injury like this, there are considerable risks to any course of action, including leaving it put.
He flipped the pen behind his ear, wiggled and stretched his fingers.
I always like to look at comparables. Tricky in your case, as I said, the odds are maybe 1 in 5,000 that you should even be alive and walking this earth. Still, there are documented cases of people surviving gunshots to the neck or skull. I pulled some recent ones that may be instructive.
He plucked a photograph from the folder. It showed teenage boys in yellow jerseys kicking a ball around a scrubby field.
A soccer team? I don't follow.
Bear with me. This is one of my favorites. It's from June, this past summer. Those boys are playing on a field in Bosnia. Same field where an unfortunate goalkeeper was playing when he started complaining that his head hurt. Article cites a Sarajevo newspaper, says the goalie completed the match, but, I'm quoting here, he soon complained of a stiff arm and had difficulty speaking. He was driven to a local hospital where doctors were shocked to see that a 9mm bullet was clearly lodged in his skull. The good news is, he's fine.
Dr. Gellert held the article out to me.
They got it out. But here's my favorite detail. Local police arrested a guest at a nearby wedding. Guy thought it would be a good idea to celebrate by firing his pistol into the air. They found another 12 shells scattered around the soccer field. Could have wiped out the entire team. God love the Balkans.
I smiled politely and handed back the paper. He started stuffing it into the folder, then froze.
Hang on, I take it back. That's not even the best bit. Listen to the kicker. For the record, Kratolica only conceded one goal while playing with a bullet in his head. One goal. Can you beat that?
Dr. Gellert was clearly enjoying himself. I tried to steer the conversation back to my predicament. Of course, that's a totally different scenario from mine.
Of course, of course.
Gellert cleared his throat.
And check the source. Yahoo News New Zealand. Perhaps not a paragon of accurate medical reporting. That's the problem with most of the cases I've turned up. They tend to happen in rural China or the favelas of Rio de Janeiro. Impossible to authenticate. But this one...
He shuffled through the folder again.
This one is interesting.
On the page before him were two black and white images that looked remarkably like the CT scan of my own head. A bright white bullet, unmistakable, resting atop a neat stack of vertebrae.
New England Journal of Medicine, said Gellert, as reputable as you can get. 3 years ago, this guy walks into a cardiology clinic in Moscow. He's 85 years old, needs treatment for heart disease.
The doctors spot something odd and ask him about it. The patient reveals that at the age of 3, his older brother accidentally shot him with a pistol.
3? That's the same age as I was.
Mm-hmm. And same as you, he exhibited no clinical or radiographic evidence of neural damage. He was a successful engineer, won the Soviet State Prize, all while walking around with a bullet in his neck for, what would that be, 82 years.
So did they remove it?
Nope. Didn't seem to have done him any harm.
I shifted on my chair. But you think you should remove mine?
Look, let me put this simply.
His fingers raced along the edge of the desk between us, back and forth, constant motion.
There's a big difference between you and that Russian engineer. His bullet wasn't bothering him, yours is. Plus, you're young and healthy, a much better candidate for surgery.
He walked me through what surgery would entail. One operation lasting 4 to 5 hours. I pressed him for details, best and worst case scenarios. We talked for another 30 minutes. As I stood to leave, I posed the question that doctors must dread. What would he do if it were him, or his daughter, or his wife? Marshall Gellert did not mince words.
If it were me, I'd want it out.
I thought you would say that.
Sorry to be predictable. You know what they say. Show a surgeon a problem, he'll want to operate on it. It's what we're trained to do. But, Ms. Cashin, as an added bonus in your case, it's also the right thing to do.
I studied his eyes, studied his hands, felt myself arrive at a decision.
Will it come out intact? I'll be able to keep it?
He looked at me strangely. As a souvenir?
I thought of Beamer Beasley, of the little house on Eulalia Road, and the horror that had played out there. As I'd slept on the plane this morning, I had dreamed of Sadie Rawson, of her smile, so like mine, beaming out from the faded newspaper photograph.
Something like that, I said.
22. Sunday, October 20th, 2013. I spent the weekend alone. I had let everything slide, and now I devoted myself to restoring a semblance of order to my life. Mail was sorted, houseplants watered, bills paid. I got the car washed and collected my dry cleaning. Will and I texted each other flirty, thinking of you messages. I phoned him on Saturday, but he did not come by, and I found that I was fine with that. The thing about being an introvert is that people get on your nerves after a while, even people you like. Whether Will could sense this or whether he was just busy, I didn't know. But after the demands of interacting with so many new people in Atlanta, I was grateful to retreat and spend time on my own. The exception to this, and one of the reasons I'd always considered myself closer to them than to anyone else, is my parents. They didn't exhaust me the way other people did. Sunday afternoon, I drove over and let myself in the kitchen door as usual. My mother cooked. My father leaned against the counter, scratched Hunt behind the ears, and chatted about the Le Carré novel he was reading. They seemed determined to carry on as though nothing had happened, to preserve the rhythms of our prior life. I understood. Informing this display of nonchalance was a desperate, almost tangible current of love. You could read in their eyes the words they were not saying out loud. You are our daughter. This is your home. Nothing has changed. I watched my mother shake an ungodly amount of salt into a bubbling pot. She glanced around, held out her hand, said nothing. I passed her the pepper grinder. When you've cooked beside someone for 30 years, you know what ingredient she wants before she knows it herself. My mother scowled at the pot, stirred, sniffed, hesitated. Nutmeg.
I passed it over. The glorious smell of chicken browning in butter filled the kitchen. For the thousandth time, I marveled at how she stayed so slim when she cooked like this every night. 74 years old, but from the back you would mistake her for a girl. Her movements had a lightness, a nervousness, like the skittish peck and hop of a sparrow. So different from the way I moved. I had never thought about it before. She held out her hand. Paprika. Over bowls of chicken and dumplings, I shared a heavily edited account of my trip to Atlanta. They already knew the headlines. I told them about my visit to Sibley Hospital, about Marshall Gellert and my decision to go ahead with surgery. They seemed to take this as a given. Apparently, I was the only one who had needed time to come round to the idea. My mother's chief concern appeared to be timing. Were the surgery and the convalescence going to conflict with my birthday dinner? My birthday fell late next month. The Cashins do not take birthdays lightly. My brothers, their wives, all my nieces and nephews would be under strict orders to appear.
Do you think we should push the date for the party forward? Mom asked. I need to know to get the food ordered. I'm planning a surprise for dinner.
If the last 20 years of birthday dinners were any guide, that meant baked potatoes and grilled T-bones. Mom is an excellent but exceedingly predictable cook. Creative menu planning is not her strength.
I'll pick up some Merlot to go with the steak, said my father.
Tom, it was supposed to be a surprise.
From across the table, he winked at me, then said,
Change of subject. I found a great new running trail down along Rock Creek, 4-mile loop. You should come with me one of these days.
That was what he said. What he meant was, I love you. I will take care of you. I am so sorry. 23.
I wondered whether I'd hear from you.
I figured you'd been waiting 34 years, another 3 days wouldn't kill you. On the other end of the phone line, Beamer Beasley chuckled.
Fair enough. How you holding up?
Okay, considering. I've been thinking. I had turned things over in my mind as I drove home from my parents' house, had called him the moment I walked in my own front door. I'm going to get the surgery to remove the bullet.
Course you are.
Why does everyone keep saying that? I could end up paralyzed. In fact, that's probably a bigger risk if I go ahead with the surgery than if I leave things alone.
I don't know about surgical risks and whatnot, he replied in that even, steady way of his. I was just reckoning, if it was me, I couldn't live with knowing where that bullet has been.
Exactly. Beasley had articulated my reasoning better than I had myself at dinner tonight with my family. You could analyze the medical pros and cons until you went blue in the face. The fact remained that the slug of metal in my neck had been responsible for the death of my biological mother. You couldn't just leave it there. The surgeon says he'll try to extract it intact. So I was thinking, maybe you would want to take a look?
As evidence, you mean?
Well, you tell me. Would it be of interest to the police? I mean, given how long ago everything happened?
Absolutely. Unless and until you get a conviction, a murder investigation remains open. New evidence is always of interest. There's a cold case squad. That's what they do.
What about the statute of limitations?
Isn't one. Not for murder.
And how does it work? I asked with genuine curiosity. What would they do with the bullet?
Run all kinds of tests on it. Measure it. Weigh it. Ideally, they'll have something to try to compare it with. A gun seized from a suspect, say, or another bullet taken from the crime scene.
But you don't have that, right? You said the bullet that killed Boone Smith was dug out of a doorframe. You never found it.
True. I'm just telling you the ideal scenario. A good ballistics tech could still do something with your bullet, though. Check for distinctive grooves on it. Maybe tell you what kind of gun fired it.
That's something, I guess.
Sure. But, Ms. Cashin,
he hesitated.
What are your expectations here? It pains me to keep saying it, but I couldn't catch your parents' killer back in 1979, and that's when the case was fresh, and we had a team working it full time. I'd caution you against getting your hopes up that anything much is likely to happen now.
Oh, I know that. I'm not expecting some dramatic arrest.
Mm-hmm. Still, you never know. I'll make a call or two. Find out what's left of the file on your family.
What's left?
Safe to say, those files would have been shifted off-site many years ago.
You mean stuff might have gotten thrown away?
Let's say misplaced.
I ran my good hand through my hair. One more thing. The suspect you arrested, or not arrested, but questioned. Cheryl Rooney says he's still alive. She gave me an address for him. Beasley sighed.
Did she now?
I'm wondering if you should go talk to him.
Why?
She's convinced it was him. She told me...
Ms. Cashin.
Beasley's voice turned stern.
I'm sorry your mama's old neighbor has got you riled up, and I don't blame you, Lord knows, stumbling on this mess after so many years. But he didn't do it. The suspect, the one she wanted us to question, he didn't do it. He had an alibi. Couldn't have been over on Eulalia Road that day. We never had diddly on him. Nothing but her say-so.
You had me. I pointed to his picture. Beasley made an exasperated clicking sound.
Yes, ma'am, you did. Right before you started pointing for a lollipop in your dolly. I've seen more reliable witnesses, is my point. You were three. You were a baby. There's not a prosecutor in the whole great state of Georgia who would hang a murder case on the testimony of a three-year-old. Certainly not one who's been scared so bad she won't speak.
24. Monday, October 21st, 2013. In the morning, I woke early and walked to Saxby's. It's not my favorite breakfast spot. That honor belongs to Patisserie Poupon, but I have to walk right past it to get from my house to the library. So does half the student body of Georgetown. By mid-morning, the lines of students jostling for lattes and chocolate muffins would be out the door. At 6, though, when Saxby's opened, I had the place to myself. I grabbed a table in the window, an enormous mug of Darjeeling, and settled in to work. I have never lost my sense of wonder that I get paid to read all day, to steep myself in the literature of another country and another century. It is a scandalously pleasant way to earn a living. I sat marking papers until nearly 9, then pushed my glasses back on my head and looked up. My cell phone was ringing. An Atlanta number, area code 404, lit up the display. Hello?
Sweet Caroline.
The oleaginous voice of the Journal Constitution's managing editor oozed into my ear.
This city is a sorrier place for your having left us, I'll tell you. It's like a light been turned out.
Hi, Leland. Oddly, he began to hum. I pressed the phone closer, straining to make out the tune.
Tell me you're not humming Neil Diamond.
You must get that a lot.
Thankfully, no, first time in quite a while.
I've been sitting here dreaming up ways to lure you back, he drawled. We never did get that drink together.
We never will, Leland. Was there something I can help you with?
Got a few messages to pass on to you. More calls coming in, people who read our article. One man says he flew with your daddy for Delta, and a lady called, think her name was Susie, says she and Sadie Rawson were sorority sisters up in North Carolina. I said I'd let you know. I'll send you all their contact information.
Thanks. That would be great. Hang on a sec. I cranked up the volume on my phone. In the hours I'd sat working, Saxby's had filled. Rihanna blared from the ceiling. Three baristas sweated over the hissing espresso machine. The entire varsity soccer team appeared to be here, dressed in matching gray and navy shorts and logo sweatshirts. 2012 Big East champions. Bleed Hoya Blue.
Where are you?
Coffee shop, trying to get work done.
Sounds more like the Kappa Alpha frat house on a Saturday night. Anyhow, listen, I spoke to Cheryl Rooney.
Did you? I sat up. Why?
Follow-up story. People are intrigued. We got such a big response to last Thursday's piece. I told you that running it was a good idea.
Oh, no, please. I don't want to be in the paper again.
Just a little story this time. Inside pages, most likely.
But what's the follow-up? There's no news.
You know, community comes together, that type thing. We'll mention all the folks who knew the Smiths, how delighted everybody is to learn you're alive and well. I got a nice quote from Cheryl about how you're the spitting image of your mama, how she couldn't believe her eyes when she saw you walking up her driveway. Like watching a ghost, she said.
Did she say anything about the investigation? Into who killed my parents?
No. He stretched the word out. Why? Is there anything to say?
Not that I know of. Just wondered. So Cheryl had not shared her infidelity theories with Leland Brett. That was one thing to be grateful for. That a lurid account of Sadie Rawson Smith's love life would not be plastered across the front page.
People are asking about the bullet, though. Whether you're going to leave it be or get operated on.
I hesitated. Could think of no reason not to be honest. I'm scheduled for surgery next week, here in Washington. Cross your fingers for me.
I'll send the biggest bouquet of get-well flowers you ever saw. Which day, you reckon?
A week from Wednesday, the 30th.
And you're sure I can't tempt you down to Atlanta for a drink in the meantime?
Goodbye, Leland.
I'll let you know when the link to this story goes up. Bye for now, pretty girl.
I hung up and looked around. Rihanna had given way to Radiohead on the speakers above me. A stink of scorched bagel hung in the air. The soccer players stood huddled in the corner, scarfing down bananas and supersized cinnamon buns. I gathered my papers and relinquished the table. In 15 minutes, I was due to meet Madame Aubuchon. To say that I was dreading this would be an understatement. Hélène Aubuchon intimidated me at the best of times, which, needless to say, this was not. She sat waiting for me in her office, immaculately dressed as always, tastefully rouged lips, a silk scarf knotted around her shoulders. At her ears and throat were pearls. The head of Georgetown's French department was not a classic beauty. She was bone-thin, with a severity to the set of her jaw, but she was elegant, in that manner particular to French women of a certain age. It required money. I suspected it also required weekly visits to the hairdresser, devotion to all manner of mysterious skin creams and potions, and, above all, fanatical vigilance to never put on a pound. I wondered when a cheeseburger had last crossed those crimson lips.
Alors, Caroline, ma pauvre, you have had quite a week, I believe.
She arched perfectly groomed eyebrows. And you discovered more than you bargained for in Atlanta? That was certainly true.
It is shocking, tout à fait affreux, about the bullet in your neck. I am so sorry.
Madame Aubuchon and I had never discussed our personal lives. Aside from the occasional polite inquiry into my summer vacation plans, she had never asked about my life outside work. We were colleagues, not friends. So I was surprised to hear real concern in her voice. I seized the moment. I went to see a surgeon at Sibley about removing the bullet. He wants to operate next week, on Wednesday, and after that he's told me to allow at least 10 days to rest and recover at home before returning to work.
10 days?
I'm afraid so. I realize the timing is awful mid-semester. I would put it off until Christmas break, but the doctor says the sooner the better.
Oui, oui, bien sûr.
She waved her hand dismissively.
That will be fine.
It will? Had I heard her correctly?
Pas de problème.
In fact, I've spoken already with Robert. Robert was one of my more capable graduate students. He had already subbed for me twice last week. He can handle your classes for the rest of the term under my supervision. That way, you can rest.
Oh, no, that won't be necessary. I'll be back by...
It is easier this way?
Vraiment.
Less disruptive for everyone?
No, really. I'll be back by mid-November, and I want to teach. Those students are my responsibility. And the smooth functioning of this department is mine.
She smiled in a way that made clear the matter was not open to further discussion.
Surely you can see it is not in your students' best interest to have a new professor every other week?
Of course not, but we're not talking about a new professor every other week. We're only talking about 10 days.
That's if your surgery proceeds without complication and you don't require additional time to convalesce. Franchement, 10 days sounds optimistic.
She crossed trim ankles sheathed in sensible beige support stockings, a rare concession to her age.
Robert did well teaching last week. He's happy to help. He will follow your syllabus. I sat seething. How could she have turned my course load over to Robert? Before even consulting me? Could she really just banish me from doing my job?
Your salary will continue as usual. I check the records. It appears you've never taken a single sick day. You've accumulated weeks of paid medical leave, so there's no issue there.
It's not my paycheck that concerns. It's settled then.
She cut me off firmly. Consider it sabbatical. You will rest and recuperate, and then return to us healthy after winter break.
Unbelievable.
This is effective immediately.
That might be best, yes.
Tie up any loose ends directly with Robert.
Now, do you have someone to look in on you every day after the operation?
My family lives nearby, I muttered through clenched teeth.
Très bien. I'll visit you as well. We are neighbors, you know. Voisine. Jean-Pierre and I live on R Street.
Oh, great. That was all I needed, to have my boss popping over for coffee. The social custom of calling on people when they are unwell has always mystified me.
By definition, you're not feeling or looking your best. Why on earth do people assume you might want visitors, that you would enjoy nothing more than to play hostess and chit-chat?
I could picture the scene. Madame Aubuchon, perfumed and pristine in full Hermes splendor, me, sore and sedated and still in my nightie. I forced a weak smile and stood to go. Madame Aubuchon watched me cross the room.
I read the article in the Atlanta newspaper. I pulled it up online. Your parents' murder was never solved.
No, I stopped with my hand on the doorknob. It wasn't.
Will the police want to interview you?
Formally, I mean?
I don't know. I was so young. I don't remember anything.
But the bullet in your neck might be evidence, n'est-ce pas?
The perfect eyebrows shot up.
Merde, quel bordel. C'est dingue.
My jaw dropped. Madame Aubuchon had just uttered a vulgarity that loosely translated meant something along the lines of, shit, what a goddamn mess.
Hélène?
I had never addressed her by her first name, but this seemed a reasonable time to start.
Did you just say, wouldn't it be incredible if they found something, after all these years? J'espère qu'ils arrêtent les salauds.
Good Lord. Not again. Still, she had a point. I hoped they caught the bastard, too. At lunchtime, Marshall Gellert called from Sibley.
No need for alarm, but I wanted to let you know about a security incident that took place here over the weekend.
Oh, okay. What kind of incident?
Unauthorized entry. Somebody gained access to the medical building yesterday morning. Building security is still checking things out, but the lock on our office door was definitely tampered with.
I tried to think why anyone would bother breaking into a doctor's office.
Was it somebody after prescription drugs, do you think? Narcotics?
That's a possibility. There's a pharmacy on the ground floor, as you may have noticed, and various samples and supplies locked up in cabinets all over the building. The good news is it doesn't look like any of our computers were compromised. But I've got my receptionists calling around to patients so they can watch out for unusual activity on the credit cards we keep on file for billing purposes.
Right. Well, thanks for the heads up.
Dr. Gellert coughed. I'm reaching out to you myself because of, an additional irregularity. Your chart seems to have disappeared.
My chart?
That purple folder that I was taking notes in. You didn't happen to take it with you, did you?
No, of course not.
Weirdest thing. I'm sure I left it on my desk so I could review my notes and follow up today. Not to worry. Your test results are backed up online and I can recreate everything else.
Maybe one of the nurses filed it?
They say they didn't. They all know not to touch papers on my desk. Anyway, sorry to have disturbed you. I'll be in touch in the next few days. Everything's on track for your surgery next week.
I sat thinking. You'll let me know if my file turns up?
Absolutely.
And if they find the guy who broke in?
Sure, if you like. Security thinks they caught him on a CC camera as he exited through the parking garage. Heavyset guy with dark curly hair. Couldn't see his face.
At home that evening, I kicked off my shoes and collapsed on the sofa. It would be hard to pinpoint which of the day's events I found most unsettling. The news that Dr. Gellert's office had illegally been entered and my chart was missing. The revelation that my elderly boss could outcurse a Marseille dock worker.